A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another podcast with Pete and Gary. And today I'll be your Pete. And instead of the usual Gary, we've got this one. Hello, other Gary.
Hello, Pete.
Good mood, eh, Gary?
Yeah. What are we doing today?
Well, we're doing Air War Over the Somme. Yes, that's it's about the fourth or fifth part, isn't it? And this one's High Summer Over the Somme. A lot of overs in that.
Yeah. It wasn't as dramatic as you made it sound.
No. So, last week in the last podcast, Gary, if you remember, which you probably don't, we did the July the 1st in the air. It was a success in the air, but it wasn't a success on the ground. It was a disaster, but it can't stop the British offensive, can it? You can't stop the main Allied offensive of 1916 just because it goes badly in the first day. So, what does Haig do?
Well, General Sir Henry Rawlinson was ordered to push home any advantage that existed on his right flank between the junction with the French and the Boisselle. Now, that's because the French had a relatively successful period.
And that's mainly down to better tactics and artillery.
Now, that was to allow him to concentrate on this task, or rather to allow him to concentrate on this task. I'll put my teeth back in.
Oh, those teeth are lovely, though, Gary.
Rawlinson was further directed to hand the reins of command in the northern sector over to General Sir Hubert Gough, whose reserve army took over the 10th and 8th Corps, covering the front line from La Boisselle to Serre.
Ooh.
Now, the 2nd German line still lay inviolate, well, more purple prose, far in front of them on the high ground of the Bazentin Ridge.
Yeah, and we ought to make clear that 2nd line is actually a system, a trench system. It's more than one line. So the next stage of the fighting is basically a serious series of battles to capture the sort of tactical staging posts which gain the ground, which would allow a full-scale assault on that German second line in mid-July. And there's a whole, on the ground, there's loads of fighting, isn't there? Name me some of the battles that were going on, or the scenes of torment. Where were they?
You had Bernefay Wood, Mametz Wood, Trones Wood, Consul Maison, and La Boisselle.
Yeah. And these places, they ring home today in various parts of the country where the battalions were smashed up. They're uncoordinated assaults. Many of them are on the narrow front. And often there's only a couple of battalions going forward. It's just piecemeal attacks. It's a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful phase. But the line does slowly inch forwards. What's the Royal Flying Corps doing, Gary?
They continued to exercise their dominance over the battlefield, but the Germans didn't always give way easily, and many British pilots were still fighting in, frankly, inadequate aircraft.
Yeah, we'd had some new aircraft come. We talked about them last time, or the time before that, the various aircraft that are your favourite and mine, Sopwith 1.5 Strutter, that had to come along, and then there was a DH2, the FE2B, and the French had the Newport Scout. But some of them were still flying, well, we'd call it crap, wouldn't we? 60 Squadron, for instance, of 9th Wing, what were they flying?
They had the obsolete Marine biplanes and Marine bullets. Neither had the benefit of synchronised machine guns, relying instead on the old system of a fixed Lewis gun firing through the... firing through the propeller fitted with a metal deflector to prevent it being shot through. The bullet in particular lacked engine power, and its pilots complained that it had the gliding angle of a brick and was dangerously prone to stalling.
At which point it would, yeah. Oh, that's a great description. You're getting so much better at the aircraft. I hope this theme continues. They're inadequate for service over the Western Front, and they're on a hide into nothing, aren't they? Let's illustrate this. 3rd of July, a flight of 60 Squadron. They're on a dawn patrol. A flight of
60 Squadron.
A flight.
Yeah, they set out on a dawn patrol.
Not our flight.
No. They set out on a dawn patrol in their Marine bullets.
You were deliberately putting me off there, were you?
Now, with them was their squadron leader, Ferdy Waldron, who, despite his clear orders, insisted in trying to personally accomplish at least one mission a day over the lines with his men. Now, he was accompanied by Captain Robert Smith Barry, Lieutenant Armstrong, Lieutenant Simpson, and an 18-year-old novice, Second Lieutenant Harold Balfour. And this is Second Lieutenant Harold Balfour of 60 Squadron. You're going to tell us what he says.
Both Armstrong and Simpson fell out through engine trouble before we reached Arras. Waldron led the remaining two along the Arras-Cambrai road. We crossed at about 8,000 feet. Just before reaching Cambrai, we were at about 9,000 feet when I suddenly saw a large formation of machines about our height coming from the sun towards us. There must have been at least 12. They were two-seaters led by one Fokker monoplane, followed by... Why do I always laugh at this? It's just... followed by two others. I'm sure they were not contemplating war at all, but Ferdy pointed us towards them and led us straight in. My next impressions were rather mixed. I seemed to be surrounded by Huns in two-seaters. I remember diving on one, pulling out the dive, and then swerving as another came for me. I can recollect also looking down and seeing a Marine about 800 feet below me going down in a slow spiral with a Fokker hovering above it, following every turn. I dived on the Fokker, who swallowed the bait and came after me, but unsuccessfully, as I had taken care to pull out of my dive while still above him. The Marine I watched gliding down under control, doing perfect turns to about 2,000 feet when I lost sight of it. I thought he must have been hit in the engine. After an indecisive combat with the Fokker, I turned home. Smith Barry I never saw from the start to finish of the fight. I landed at Vertgallant and reported that Ferdy had gone down under control. And it was Ferdy Waldron who was in that aircraft.
Yeah, in fact, he'd been mortally wounded. And although he survived the crash landing, he died that night. And afterwards, Balfour was haunted by his role in the fight. He was unable to accept that he had been helpless to change Waldron's fate. Aware, too, of the inferior nature of his aircraft, he, in effect, lost all confidence in his own abilities.
Yeah, we've talked about him before in other podcasts. His nerve went and he's in a terrible state.
Yeah.
And it's... What heroic incident eventually sends him home, Gary?
Yeah, it's rather bizarre. He's sent home after crushing his fingers in a deck chair.
Have you done that? Because I have.
I have, yeah. It's very
bloody
painful.
Hurts.
But he wasn't a coward. He returned to the front twice more.
No, he had problems with his nerves. He wasn't a coward. A very different thing, isn't it? Now, the scout pilots, they've got a punishing schedule, but why are they so important? We've said hundreds of times the core machines are what matters, the ones doing the reconnaissance.
Well, they're vital to protect those core machines. And it was a strain even to the bravest of the brave, Albert Ball, in his Newport Scout.
And who's going to be him?
I'm going to be Second Lieutenant Albert Ball of 11 Squadron.
Best Nottinghamshire public school voice, please.
Really, one has only just time to button up one's tunic. I'm having a poo-poo time, but most interesting. On the 6th, three topping chaps went off and never returned. Yesterday, four of my best pals went off, and today, one of our new chaps has gone over. So you can guess we're always having to get used to new faces. Yesterday, I was up at 5 a.m, and during the day had 12 fights.
Flights.
But at
very
last,
similar word, Gary.
But at last, nature is asking to have its own way. However, I'm not done yet. I shall get at them again soon.
Yeah, it's that classic changing. You can tell people's nerves are starting to go a bit or be affected because they change, don't they, within a couple of lines. Now, he's starting to suffer from strain, and he just had some leave, but he puts in a request to his squadron leader for more leave, more rest. That's bold. How does his squadron leader and then ultimately the brigadier in charge of the wing react?
Well, Brigadier General John Frederick Adams, who was known as Jack, he was commanding 3rd Brigade, and he couldn't just grant requests for willy-nilly, as it would inevitably set a dangerous precedent. If every exhausted pilot could take rest as they pleased,
they would.
They'd be in real trouble, wouldn't they?
They would.
And instead, Guess what happened to him?
I've no idea.
Well, he was sent to 8 Squadron, so he's back on to B2Cs.
So Albert Ball, the primary scout pilot on the Western Front, is on the British side, is sent back to observation and artillery.
Yeah, he becomes a corps pilot, doesn't he?
Well, that's a bit of a blow for him. Now, well, let's go back to the corps pilots, because we make, I mean, the scout pilots are busy, but they're protecting them. That's what they're doing. What are they up to? Well, they've got a ceaseless grind of photographic reconnaissance and artillery observation work. Why can't they just do it once?
Well, because as the battlefield changes beneath them, so the photos have to be taken and retaken to allow the staff to monitor and interpret the slightest change in the German defence works. The roar of the guns never ceased along the line.
Bang, bang.
And this is Lieutenant Leslie Horridge of 7 Squadron Royal Flying Corps.
You have to pilot the machine, watch the target for the burst and work the wireless, all at the same time, while Archie is probably at work also. The aeroplane signals to the battery by wireless, and the battery signals to the aeroplane by strips of white cloth on the ground. It is a common fallacy to think that you can see everything from an aeroplane. It's often very hard to make out details. When ranging with shrapnel, it's quite easy to see the burst, but with high explosive, it's quite difficult. Unless you're watching the place where the shell bursts at the right moment, you will miss it, as the smoke is brown and cannot be seen against the ground. And all you can see is the earth thrown up, which of course falls back in a second. You're usually at a height of about 8,000 feet, although some days you have to come much lower. All the time, you have to be on the lookout for Huns. Blimey.
The Corps aircraft were, of course, benefiting from the fruits of aerial dominance. The artillery observation aircraft were almost immune from the attentions of the German scouts, pinned back miles behind their own lines by the British offensive patrols.
So that's what the scouts are doing, isn't it? Yeah.
As the piecemeal attacks continued on the ground, so contact patrols continued to be flown to try to give the generals some idea of how their troops had progressed.
Well, this was never resolved, as we've said, on numerous occasions throughout the war, and they give lots of different plans, things are doing, whether it be triangles on backs, all sorts of things. At the end of the war, if you read quotes from the pilots, it's the Mark I eyeball still. They fly low and see what happens, see who shoots at them. That's the way they find out. But there were some splendid, splendid suggestions as to how to solve the problem. And my favourite, you're going to relate, and this is from, he's a cantankerous bugger, but it's so it suits your character perfectly. It's Lieutenant Thomas Hughes of 1 Squadron RFC. What does he like to be called? Tommy. What does Tommy say?
Major Lumsden of the 5th Corps also arrived with a couple of ordinary umbrellas, painted half-white in sections. His idea was that the infantry should indicate their position to an aeroplane by opening and shutting their umbrellas. I think he was rather offended when I laughed. I did not gather whether it would be the colonel who would leap over the parapet with a joyous shout and lead the charge, brandishing his umbrella.
Fantastic character. I'll tell you what, one day somebody ought to publish Thomas Hughes's thing. It's fabulous. And he is killed in the end. Sorry to bring a downer on it. Killed in, I think, 1918. But what a character. He's cantankerous about everything. That's not an isolated incident of sarcasm. Anyway, day after day, they're launching also, besides all this, they're launching raids on German airfields. Where's the best time to destroy a German scout or aircraft?
Whilst they're immobile on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly if the pilot's in bed, that's even better.
But they also killed highly trained ground personnel, destroyed hangars and technical equipment, harassed the already exhausted pilots, and of course disrupted the crucial repair and maintenance work that had to be undertaken every day by the mechanics. So it wasn't just destroying the
absolutely. But as ever, you've hit the nail on the head. It makes a change from hitting me on the head. Now, they're also bombing something else. And this is the old, your favourite and the best joke you've ever told, interdiction.
Yeah, the main railway towns and junctions, they're also prime targets. It's important to ensure that aircraft kept formation or the stragglers would be picked off by the German scouts.
Particularly on the way back, because, of course, they know what's happening then, yeah.
The latter, i.e. the German scouts, hesitated to attack a well-drilled formation acting in concert and bristling with machine guns, but fell on isolated lone aircraft with ruthless precision.
Yeah, so on the ground, it boils up again. Now, this is the next stage, is the big attack on Friday, 14th of July. I think it's a very, tactics have moved on. It's amazing how quickly it's known as the Battle of Bazentin Wood. And it's in the right sector of the line, stretching where, what you say, Longville, facing Delville Wood, that's on the right, to Bazentin Le Petit Wood on the left, I think. I've got my rights and lefts. I think I got it right. Then that starts it off again. And for the next month, there's vicious fighting. It's going backwards and forwards, round about Highwood and Delville Wood. How would you describe the fighting in late July, August 1916?
It was an attritional period where the strength of the German army was to be worn down, ready for another major offensive in mid-September on the original German third line in front of the village of Flers. As the fighting raged on the ground, aerial reconnaissance missions were vital to track the movements of rail and road traffic behind the German lines.
Why, Gary? Why?
Well, this was an attempt to piece together the movement of German reserves.
So the Germans, the RFC is doing everything it wants. The Germans bring in more aircraft. They're desperate, aren't they, to get back to some sort of parity in the skies. They bring in more aircraft. They get to up to 164 aircraft. They're trying to get every aircraft they could into the Somme skies, but they're still having trouble. Late July, there's some serious battles up in the skies, aren't there? Because the reinforced German scout formations are trying to stop the raids on their rail junctions. So let's have a look at one. This is on 30th of July. Seven Martin sides of 27 Squadron, escorted by four Sopwith 1.5 Strutters of 70 Squadron, make an attack on the rail junction at My Coin. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Robert Usher of 27 Squadron says. The patrol seemed to break up just as we were crossing the lines. As I didn't see any signals to return, as I still had a Sopwith with me, I went on to Marcoing and dropped my bombs, both of which fell in the village. I turned quickly round and almost ran into an LVG. Gary, do you remember what an LVG is?
Luftverkehrgesellschaft. It's named after the factory.
Oh, and where is the factory?
Germany.
Damn! I gave him a drum and he went down underneath me. I saw the Sopwith take him on, and whilst I was changing drums, I was attacked again in front by a Roland gang.
That's commonly known as the WOW, and that was from the Luftwaffe zur Gesellschaft, the LFG factory.
You become quite an expert on German.
That was also in Germany.
Yeah, there's no end to your knowledge. That gave him a drum, and at the same time, I heard a machine gun behind me, looked around and saw three Rolands on my tail. I was hit in the leg almost immediately, but managed to give them a drum and my side gun, and they went away. My engine started spluttering. I saw a hole in my petrol tank. My engine stopped, so I started gliding down, thinking I should have to land. Petrol was flowing all over my left leg, so I put my left knee over the hole in the petrol tank. Oh, Jesus. It struck me... He didn't say that. That was me. Sorry. It struck me that by pumping, I might be able to get a little pressure. By this time, I was about 200 feet up. The engine started. I was then about 15 miles from our lines. I kept pumping hard all the time. Managed to keep just enough engine to keep going. I thought I should have to land three or four times. Once I actually flattened out to land, but my engine just picked up in time. I came back to the lines for about 15 miles at an average height of 50 feet. During the time that I was flying so low, I was subject to a lot of rifle and machine gun fire. I had lost myself and was so low that I could see very little of the country. I then picked up with a Horace French biplane. Horace, Gary?
Horace.
It's just a name, is it?
It's just a French name.
Yeah. You're not an expert on French airplanes?
No, just German.
Just German, okay. That was flying low. Followed him. And eventually landed at Moril. airplane. Crashing aerodrome. I was laughing at your French pronunciation, so probably made a mistake. Crashing the machine on landing. I was feeling very weak, as I'd lost a lot of blood and was exhausted by having to pump so long. What a story, Gary.
Can you imagine that? I mean, that is just so, so heroic, really.
Well, he could have just landed. He'd be out of the war. He'd be safe enough. Oh, what a man. Wow.
Now, the pattern of fighting, which had been established in mid-July, continued right through August. Desperate attacks by just a few British battalions to gain some tactically significant feature, their desperate efforts to consolidate any gains, and the equally determined German counterattacks.
Oh, let's have a little bit of a break to think about it, Gary, eh?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Right. Well, in all this fighting, the Royal Flying Corps continues to play its part, doesn't it? By this time, it's central to the detailed planning of the attacks. Contact patrols, where the troops have got to. Aerial photography exposes the exact location of trench lines, machine gun posts, trench mortars, headquarters, artillery batteries. Royal Artillery is beginning to kowtow to the... It's getting used to the idea that it's got to do what the people in the sky tell them, that the amateurs up there in the sky can see better than they can. The bombing raids, they're getting bigger in scale. It's not like the Second World War, is it? But all of it's bitter and costly, and it's just all going off. The whole the Royal Flying Corps is becoming crucial, isn't it? What does the German High Command think of all this? Do we have any inkling of that, Gary?
Well, they're becoming only too aware of their situation. And this is General Fritz von Below of the Headquarters German First Army.
Is he related to Blücher?
Yeah. The beginning and the first weeks of the Somme battle were marked by a complete inferiority of our own air forces. The enemy's aeroplanes enjoyed complete freedom in carrying out distance reconnaissances. With the aid of aeroplane observation, the hostile artillery neutralized our guns and was able to range with the most extreme accuracy on the trenches occupied by our infantry. The required data for this was provided by undisturbed trench reconnaissance and photography. By means of bombing and machine gun attacks from a low height against infantry, battery positions and marching columns, the enemy's aircraft inspired our troops with a feeling of defenselessness against the enemy's mastery of the air. On the other hand, our own aeroplanes only succeeded in quite exceptional cases in breaking through the hostile patrol barrage and carrying out distance reconnaissances. Our artillery machines were driven off whenever they attempted to carry out registration for their own batteries. Photographic reconnaissance could not fulfil the demands made upon it. Thus, at decisive moments, the infantry frequently lacked the support of the German artillery, either in counter-battery work or in barrages on the enemy's infantry massing for attack.
Wow, now that is an interesting statement. And one of the, as you know, Gary, I have many, many enemies. And there's nothing better than being praised by them. Not that that happens for me very often. But there is no greater praise than the praise of your enemies, is there? And the admiration of one's enemies. So let's go back to a couple of individuals that we're slightly tracking through this high summer. Now, what's happening to... I nearly called him Alan again. What's happening in early August to young Albert Ball? He's been sent back to 8th Squadron, isn't he? He's on a BE2C. So what's he doing?
Well, he's serving his penance, isn't he, as it were.
He's been a naughty boy.
And he undoubtedly found the regular routine of artillery observation and bombing flights far less stressful than the pell-mell life of a scout pilot. And he was able to recover much of his early zest for the fray. he played his full part in the day-to-day work of the squadron, but once he'd recovered, it's perhaps fair to say that Ball was not just as other BE-2C pilots. He was looking for opportunities to put himself forward and get sent back to the scouts.
Now, one of the stories I most love you're going to tell now. This is the occasion he volunteered to land a spy. A spy, Gary, at night on the German side of the lines. How does it go for Albert Ball?
We got over the lines and after a few seconds, three Fokkers came after us. We had no gun, for the machine could not carry his luggage, etc., and guns, so we had to dodge the beasts. At last, it was so dark they could not see us, so they went down. The Archie guns started. Also, rockets were sent up to try and set us on fire. Oh, it was nice. I really did think that the end had come. The planes were lit up with the flashes. However, at last we found a landing place and we started down. Naturally, everything had to be done quickly or we would have been caught. But we got down. Picture my temper when we landed. The damned spy would not get out. The Fokkers had frightened him and he would not risk it. There was nothing to do but get off again before the Huns came along and stopped us. So off we went. I went down three times again after this, but the rotter refused to do his part, so we had to return.
Oh, those
it can be imagined that the circumstances of the flight that had rattled even Ball might drive a relatively normal spy into a state of abject terror.
Now, that's not all he does, because he also he launches an attack on a pair of German observation balloons. The Kite balloons, these are the ones that provide intelligence and spotting for the German artillery. What does Albert say about this?
On Wednesday, August the 9th, I attacked a balloon with a BE and forced the observer to jump out. On the way back from this job, my main spar and wingtip was crashed, but we got back to the aerodrome. Lieutenant Hervey was my observer. He means Lieutenant Hamilton Elliot Hervey, who was known as Tim, I believe.
I bet he was a public school boy.
I should think so.
Well, actually, funnily enough, we've got an account from Tim Hervey. He was known as Tim. During this balloon busting exploit, there's another BE-2C with him, and that's piloted by Captain G.A. Parker. So they're all off. And this is what Harvey, remember, Harvey's with Ball. And he says this: as soon as we poked our nose across no man's land, the ever watchful anti-aircraft guns started up. I looked across the 5 miles or so between us and Parker's machine. It was easy to spot. Parker was lower than we were and making for his target, as always, like a bull at a gate. His machine was surrounded by the rather innocent-looking white puffs of shrapnel and by the very much more vicious and noisy black bursts of high explosives. Meanwhile, the gunners were putting up a spectacular display around our machine. It had been hit a number of times by stray fragments, but the damage was superficial. We saw the balloon starting to descend, and soon it was going down at an astonishing rate, swaying drunkenly under the pull of the winch cable. Ball started to dive, and the next moments were a confused jumble of sights and sounds. Men running as we fired down on the balloon, machine gunning from the emplacements around the winch site, a glimpse of the balloon observer floating down by parachute, an exploding shell knocking off a chunk of our port lower wingtip and fracturing a main spar. Ball was yelling at me to keep my eyes skinned for Huns as I switched the Lewis gun onto the rear mounting, and we started for home. Fortunately, the sky was empty of aircraft. And it's interesting, Ball's fairly laconic account compared to the rather excited and with good reason account from Tim Tom, as he liked to be called.
Now, finally, Ball had his wish granted.
Hooray!
He was returned to 11 Squadron on the 14th of August. His experience of air fighting had been broadened considerably, but it was immediately apparent that he'd not abandoned his attacking philosophy one iota. No odds seemed to be too great. And this is Lieutenant Albert Ball, now back with 11th Squadron. And he says this: met 12 Huns. Number one fight. I attacked and fired two drums, bringing the machine down just outside a village. All crashed up. Number two fight. I attacked and got under machine, putting in two drums. Hun went down in flames. Number three fight. I attacked and put in one drum. Machine went down and crashed on a housetop. All these fights were seen and reported by other machines that saw them go down. I only got hit 11 times, so I returned and got more ammunition. This time, luck was not at all on the spot. I was met by about 14 Huns, about 15 miles over their side. My windscreen was hit in four places, mirror broken, the spar of the left plane broken, also engine ran out of petrol. But I had good sport and good luck, but only just, for I was brought down about 1 mile over our side.
Unbelievable. Can you just remind me where the windscreen would have been in relation to Ball?
Right in front of his head, basically. Now, there's no doubt that Ball was phenomenally lucky.
What was he?
Phenomenally lucky. Seemingly, he could fly into a hail of bullets time and time again to emerge with his aircraft shot to pieces, but he himself unscathed. Now, luck is difficult to quantify objectively, but there's no doubt that whatever it was, Ball had it.
He did. Now, on 24th of August, as a bit of a reorganisation, Lieutenant Albert Ball was posted to 60th Squadron and given command of a flight. Can you imagine? He's so successful. Other people wanted to know how he did it. There's a lot of interest. How's he do it? How is he so successful? Can I do it? And Ball sums up his method. What does Ball say is his method?
When I get to close quarters, I generally pretend that I'm going to attack from above. The Hun gets ready to fire up at me as I pass over, and then I suddenly dive under his machine. And if I'm lucky, I empty a drum into his petrol tank and down he goes.
Unbelievable. And he's got a method. You've got to remember, he's at this point flying a Newport Scout, which has got a Lewis gun on the top wing, which can be adjusted to fire straight upwards. You've got to bear that in mind. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Roderick Hill, also 60 Squadron, with Ball, says. To surprise his enemy, he made clever use of the Lewis gun mounted on the Newport Scout. There was a curved rail down which the gun had to be run to change drums. That's ammunition drums. By exerting pressure on one side of the stock of the gun, he held it rigid when nearly down and pointed upwards at about 80 degrees. By skillful manoeuvre and incidentally by pluck and determination, he was able to zoom up beneath his intended victim, then by a slight oscillation of the control stick to cause his gun to rake the target fore and aft at a range of 30 feet or so. I found that my own efforts to emulate Ball in reaching a favourable position beneath the Hun so irritated it that a melee ensued in which I soon lost any idea what was underneath and what was its top. In other words, he gets completely confused because he can't do the two things at once. There was a nickname for what this was. Do you remember what it was? We mentioned it before. What they called what Ball did to the German pilot above him?
A balls up, I think it was. Something like
Your
that.
Your memory is phenomenal. Why did they call it a balls up?
Because they didn't want to call it a cock up.
Because his name's Ball and he would hit them in the balls.
Now, at the back of their minds, all airmen were aware that for all the risks that they took, they were in a relatively privileged position when you compared it to their comrades in the infantry.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, they're in a welter of mud and blood up to their, you know, it's the usual cliches of things. But it's true, during the Somme, it was a nightmare. And the big thing, and we've written a whole book about this, what's the book called?
Laugh or Fly.
That's it. It's very similar to a previous book. But the key point is that unlike the poor bloody infantry, they can at least get away from danger when the flying's done. So when they've done the flying for the day, they have a decent bed and the rest of it. What does Lieutenant Ewart Garland of 10 Squadron RFC say about this?
We enjoyed a Battle of Waterloo sort of life. Active flying being interspersed with riding, tennis, visits to Bethune for teas, dinners, drinking, etc.
What's the etc., Gary?
Etc. Our mess life was at this period also of a Waterloo flavour, with meals, correct wines, including port, circulated in a correct and proper manner. Liqueurs with coffee were de rigueur. This officer and gentleman kind of life did not last long, and before many weeks had passed, war conditions set in and life became much less pleasant, with a growing fear of death seldom far off.
Yeah.
I mean, that brings its own problems in terms of stress.
Yeah. This is what Lieutenant Leslie Horridge said of 7 Squadron, he was RFC. We're under canvas and have our mess in the open in a small wood. It's very nice when the weather is as hot as it has been lately. Although we are within range of the shellfire from big guns at present, you would not know there was a war on. I'm sitting in a wood out of the sun. The wind is blowing the wrong way to hear the guns, and the only things to be heard are a machine gun shooting away in the distance and the mess gramophone. Fabulous.
Now, life in the mess could indeed be simple fun, as the young pilots in the prime of life revelled in their relative freedom. And this is Second Lieutenant Lessel Hutchin of 5 Squadron. Thanks ever so much for the pastries and the cake. They were ripping. But really, though, you mustn't trouble so much over me in the food line, for we have to pinch ourselves and tell each other there's a war on sometimes when we get some unusual delicacies. By the same post, I got a pound of lovely nut chocolate from S. We had a tremendous scrap in the mess over it when I discovered what it was, and it ended up with a box of chocolate on the floor with me on top of it and 5 people on top of me. When they discovered that the more people there were on top of me, the further off became the chocolate, they got up and I handed it round in the usual civilised manner. It was great fun, though, and the chocolate being in a tin did not suffer.
That's a lovely quote. We should have put that in the book, but I don't think we did we? All in all, mess life, pretty convivial, isn't it? The stress is there, but this is Lieutenant Hugh Chance. He was 27 Squadron. We had a cheery mess, particularly when clouds made flying impossible or when all pilots had returned safely from a raid. Captain Maurice Baring, Trenchard's ADC, came to visit us from time to time and was adept in keeping us amused with various parlour tricks, such as balancing a liqueur glass on his bald head whilst reciting a doggerel verse. Writer and poet, he had the knack of keeping up our spirits and advising his master about the morale of his squadrons, his master being, of course, Trenchard. I think he was a little bit more than ADC, but he's just main staff officer, but a fantastic character. And did they drink too much?
It is true that many officers drank probably a little more than was good for them, but then most men did when away from civilising influences.
We're just going away from civilising.
We are, yes.
Where are we going, Gary?
We're going to Epes, Pete.
Are we going to have any civilising influences?
No. Now, pilots knew their responsibilities and, with occasional exceptions, they took a reasonably sensible attitude to drinking. For, at the back of the jolly japes and jokes, lay the ever-present fear of death, which each one of them had to come to terms with in their own way. And this is Sergeant Harold Taylor of 25 Squadron.
What was the great difference between trench life and this life? In the trenches, you faced death every second, not knowing when it would come to you. But in the flying corps, you could certainly say between flights that you had so many more hours to live. On the other hand, in the air, you could see death coming to you. If your machine caught fire at a good height with no parachute, you knew that it was the end. You could either stay in the machine or jump. But either way, death was coming for you.
Yet despite it all, it's noticeable that they did not hate their German opposite numbers. And this is once more Lieutenant Ewart Garland of 10 Squadron. The use of the word Hun for enemy aircraft persisted throughout, but was never meant to be derogatory nor derisory. I would go so far as to say that flying men on both sides felt less personal antagonism towards their antagonists than, say, footballers in the heat and excitement of play.
Now, I'm not sure about
that. I agree with that.
I seem to remember a couple of football matches recently where they kicked large chunks out of each other and hated each other. But it's the point. I think footballers were a little more gentlemanly in those days. So what's going on? What is their line in front of them? What happens? What's next?
Well, throughout that long, hot summer, they fight on, and we'll find out more in the next exciting episode.
I can't wait. Cheers.
Cheers, Pete.
Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit
www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH. Or visit www.blahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?